If you are a Catholic that is engaged at all, you probably have at least a faint idea that in 2022, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops began a national Eucharistic revival, which is to run until Pentecost 2025. Though some would really say it culminated with the National Eucharistic Congress held in Indianapolis in July of 2024. This was prompted by a 2019 Pew Research study that indicated that almost 70% of all Catholics do not believe in one of the most fundamental tenets of Catholicism, that the Eucharist is really and truly the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. Most of these folks did not know what the Church taught about the Eucharist, specifically about transubstantiation. Yet shockingly, greater than 1 in 5 Catholics, 22%, reject belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, even when knowing what the Church teaches. Add to this the abysmal numbers of Catholics that attend church weekly, which a recent study put at 70%, and you've got a real crisis on your hands. While some dispute these claims, and other studies showed the numbers weren't quite as bad, I actually think these initial findings are closer to the truth. Whatever the case, the revival was an attempt to respond to these shocking numbers. Now, the reality is that dioceses and parishes across the country responded with varying levels of enthusiasm and commitment to the revival. Some jumped in with both feet, but in some places, you would hardly know that a revival was happening. The National Eucharistic Congress indeed was a bright light, attracting about 60,000 people, as were the Eucharistic processions which led up to the Congress, which came from north, south, east, and west, tracing the shape of a cross over the entire country and covering over 6,500 miles before converging on Indianapolis. The impact and follow-up to all this, though, still remains to be seen. But after all is said and done, will what the Eucharistic revival attempted, though good, actually accomplish the goal? Or is there an elephant in the room with regard to the plummeting belief in the real presence or mass attendance that no one is really willing to address, and a simple solution that would have had a budget of exactly $0 that no one is willing to put into place? And is this yet another example of how the Catholic Church has lost its edge? Well, I'm Dr. David Hajduk, and here's my take.
Ave Maria Mutual Funds, seeking the moral high ground for 20 years. Pro-life, pro-family, and Catholic values have guided us to the top.
And don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to this podcast and give us a 5-star rating. Now, before I begin, I don't want anyone to get me wrong. I am not saying that the Eucharistic revival wasn't a noble and good idea. The state of things being what they are regarding the dearth of belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the abysmal numbers of Catholics attending Mass every Sunday, something had to be done. Especially if, as we believe, the Eucharist is the source and summit of the Christian life. I'm also not making any negative judgments about the wonderful programs that were developed to help heighten awareness of the real presence, providing much-needed catechesis and opportunities for encountering our Blessed Lord in the Eucharist, whether through adoration, processions, and the like. We at Array of Hope made our own contribution to such efforts through our Behold Eucharistic mission. And I have already praised the efforts of the National Eucharistic Congress. So what I am going to offer here is not so much a critique of what has been done. Rather, it is a critique of what has not been done, nor even really considered, and yet would bring about a real Eucharistic revival, and I'd like to suggest, do so quickly and without spending any money. The good news is that these still could be implemented. if there was the will to do so. Before I dive in, much of what I am going to share here comes from a great article that appeared online on the Catholic Thing website, which I highly recommend. The article was written by Father Peter Stravinskas, and the title was, What's Really Needed for a Eucharistic Revival? What Father shared there confirmed many of my own thoughts on the matter. He basically suggested that a number of the changes to the liturgy, none of which Vatican II actually called for, and many of which Vatican II expressly stated should not take place, have actually communicated something unintended, or at least I pray was unintended, namely, that the Eucharist just symbolizes Jesus and really need not be taken too seriously. I will sprinkle some of my own ideas throughout as well, but for those who are interested, I really recommend looking up the article. I would like to add that while what I am sharing here may seem controversial, many of these very suggestions were championed by the likes of Cardinal Robert Sarah and Pope Benedict XVI himself. Even if such changes were never officially made when Benedict was Pope or Cardinal Sarah was the prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments. So, what would bring about a real and swift Eucharistic revival? Father Stravinskas begins by lamenting the loss of Latin. Believe it or not, while opening up the possibility of the greater use of the vernacular in the Mass, especially for the readings, Vatican II expressly said that Latin should be retained, and that the faithful should know the Latin prayers, responses, and even the chant responses. A sacral language is part and parcel of religion and worship, and Latin was such a language for Roman Catholics. For those who would argue that Jesus didn't say the Last Supper in Latin, I would say that such a statement is irrelevant and misguided. First, the Mass isn't a replay of the Last Supper, nor was it ever supposed to be. Secondly, Jesus likely used a form of Hebrew for the Passover meal that was no longer in use. That is, he used a sacral language and not the vernacular. If the Eucharist is sacred and holy, then a sacral language would speak loudly to that, even if, much of the time, the Latin was said inaudibly. Yet the silence itself would speak loudly. But more on that later. Father Stravinskas also discusses the way the priest faces during the Mass. Vatican II never called for the priest to face the people. In fact, it is a true novelty that is not present in the worship of any religion centered on sacrificial worship. Christian worship was always to the east, in Latin, ad orientem, that is, towards Christ, in anticipation of the second coming. Churches were built with this in mind. The priest and the people all faced the same way, toward God. Some bring up that the priest facing the people was done at one time in Rome, but actually, that is an exception that proves the rule. The basilica there was built in such a way that the priest facing the people was actually the priest facing the east. It wasn't about facing the people, but about facing the east. And interestingly, at the canon, the entire community turned around to face east. So the people had their backs to the priest. So what is the problem? Not only is it a break with liturgical tradition, not representing an organic development, but it places the focus on all the wrong things. First, especially in churches that are in the round, we are facing each other, as if we, the community, are the focus of the worship. Second, it actually is more priest-centric than the priest facing away. In the latter case, the individual personality of the priest fades as he is Christ offering himself under the veils of bread and wine. In the former case, it appears more as a performance. There is an individual, eye contact. And all of this inclines to the ad-libbing and informality we often find. The sense of transcendence is impeded. The focus on God is obscured. And we are left looking at each other. At the elevation, when the priest is ad orientem, he disappears, and the focus is on Jesus lifted up as he was on the cross. These are very thought-provoking points. And these points were made by Cardinal Seurat and Pope Benedict XVI on many occasions. But we should also consider how we approach receiving the Eucharist, or even how we regard the church building itself, where Christ's presence dwells, unlike anywhere else. First, let's hear more about our sponsor for this episode.
Ave Maria Mutual Funds are actively managed with contrarian thinking. Their independent research and analysis provide a deep understanding of our investments with the intent to avoid or minimize unpleasant surprises. This helps to ensure that their funds' investments match your moral beliefs. The advisor invests in securities only if they meet the fund's investment and religious requirements, and as such, the return may be lower or higher than if the advisor made decisions solely based on investment considerations. The fund's method of security selection may or may not be successful, and the fund may underperform or outperform the stock market as a whole. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. For a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, charges, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, call 1-866-AVE-MARIA. That's 1-866-283-6274. Or visit the link above or below in the description. Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of A Reason for Hope podcast. If you're enjoying this podcast, you should download the Array of Hope app. We have tons of great Catholic family-friendly videos, movies, series, all kinds of stuff to help you grow deeper in your Catholic faith. Sign up for an account at the link above or below in the description and download the app on your favorite device. Not only is this available on your phone and desktop, but it's also available on Roku, Apple TV as well. We'll see you there.
Father Stravinskas goes on to discuss the change from receiving Holy Communion kneeling and on the tongue to standing and in the hand. No matter what some try to say about it, in the hand is not a more ancient practice. The main text cited is from St. Cyril of Jerusalem in the 4th century. But there is thin historical evidence that this was the normative way of receiving. And even if it were, what St. Cyril describes bears little resemblance to the way communion in the hand occurs today. He discussed making a throne shape with your right hand, moving your hand to your mouth, taking the host with your tongue, while your left hand acts as a paten. He warned about the reverence that should accompany all of this, the importance of being purified from sin before receiving, and the urgency of losing none of the particles of the sacred host, which would be an abomination. The way people receive today would shock St. Cyril and please the Protestant reformers who didn't believe in the real presence of Christ and wanted to make changes to diminish such belief. But on some level, this is not even relevant. The church moved to receiving on the tongue and kneeling with a paten under the chin as the norm because she recognized that there were serious problems with receiving on the hand. First among them was the problem of losing particles of the Eucharist and thus treating the body and blood of Christ fully present in every particle sacrilegiously. Great care was afforded by the priests to purifying their hands and the sacred vessels due to this understanding. In fact, after the consecration, the priest would not separate his thumb and forefinger except over the ciborium or paten when distributing communion, until the ablutions. Not to mention, the priest is Christ, who feeds us, and we receive humbly, becoming like little children. It is interesting to note that while those in Eastern Rite churches receive standing, they are still fed by the priest with the bread, now the body of Jesus, dipped into the wine, now his blood, with a spoon. It is also interesting to note that Vatican II did not call for this change. The majority of bishops were against it, and so was Paul VI, who promulgated the new Mass. It was allowed by indult, that is, by exception, at the request of certain bishops' conferences. However, since the faithful cannot be refused reception of communion in the hand, I recommend that a message can be sent by encouraging people to receive on the tongue and making doing so while kneeling easier. For example, some parishes have a kneeler on each side of the Eucharistic ministers, so if someone wishes to kneel and receive on the tongue, they aren't disrupting a line. This was never an issue when there were altar rails. I have found that when the option is given, most will take the opportunity. There is something intuitive in people that this is the most fitting way to reverence the body and blood of the Lord and to receive. The Church has believed this to be so for most of her existence. And so did Cardinal Seurat and Pope Benedict, by the way. As a little aside, the priest still purifies his hands and the sacred vessels, though with varying degrees of care depending on the priest. Have you ever seen the other Eucharistic ministers purify their hands? What about everyone who receives in the hand? Just something to think about. What message does that send? Father Stravinskas also highlights the changes in the fast prior to the reception of Holy Communion. Originally, this fast was from midnight prior to receiving. In 1957, Pope Pius XII changed the fast to 3 hours before receiving. Then, in 1964, Pope Paul VI changed it to 1 hour. Depending on how far you travel to get to Mass, this can amount to not eating on the way to church. It is so inconsequential that many people simply disregard the fast, or if they forget and eat, receive anyhow, which is a sin against a precept of the Church. Whatever the reason for relaxing the law, it is obvious that the idea of preparing for the reception of Holy Communion, this sacred encounter when we become one with the body, blood, soul, and divinity of the Lord, has been all but completely lost. Along with this has been any real mention of needing to be in a state of grace in order to receive, that is, being free from the knowledge of grave sin, from breaking God's commandments in a serious manner. It seems that no one goes to confession anymore, but everyone goes up to receive the Lord. According to the writings of St. Paul and the constant teaching of the Church, to do so would be to profane the body and blood of the Lord, to commit a sacrilege, and eat and drink judgment on oneself. In other words, there's no communion, but condemnation. The general point is this. We need to get back to preparing ourselves to receive Jesus. This will instill in us a greater appreciation for what we are doing and for whom we are receiving, and thus a greater reverence for the Eucharist. I recommend the return to the 3-hour fast. It really isn't a burden, but it does require attention, which is part of the point. Lastly, and this is mostly my own addition, I think how we act in and regard the church building is also an issue. Churches have effectively become meeting halls, not a house of prayer, God's temple. If Jesus is God, the Almighty, all-knowing, eternal, infinite in glory, in power, and in majesty, become man, and the Eucharist is bread, become Jesus, then the Almighty, all-knowing, eternal God, infinite in glory, in power, and in majesty, dwells in the tabernacle in every Catholic church. God is everywhere, but he isn't everywhere the same way. The church is the only place on earth where he is physically. Thus, our demeanor in a church should be one of awe and wonder and holy fear and reverence. It was a common practice, therefore, to observe silence in church. It's not an auditorium or a place for catching up with the neighbors. Perhaps part of the problem, and Father Stravinskas mentions this, is that the tabernacles in so many churches were moved off to the side. Out of sight, out of mind. There is so much movement and unnecessary talking in the sanctuary, and the tabernacle is being crossed in front over and over with barely a nod of recognition. To an outsider, would it appear as if we believe what we say we do? But it is God's house, not a meeting hall. And we should be struck speechless at the thought of the one who dwells there. And this reverential attitude and silence needs to begin with the clergy. Furthermore, this knowledge should impact the way we dress when we go to church as well. Who are we going there to see? What is the occasion? Our dress should match both. And every time we pass a church, we should make some gesture, a bow of the head, or a sign of the cross, acknowledging the presence of the one who is really and truly present there. There is a principle in theology, lex orandi, lex credendi, lex vivendi. It can be understood as the law of prayer is the law of belief, is the law of living. In other words, as we pray, so will we believe, and so will we live. I think a big part of the reason belief in the real presence has waned, and so few are practicing, is actually because of the changes to how we pray. Believe it or not, the Reformed Mass actually adopted many of the changes the Protestant reformers from Luther in Germany to Cranmer in England to Calvin in Geneva made in order to eclipse belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, the priesthood, and the sacrificial nature of the Mass. So whatever catechetical failures may have been, and there were those, perhaps the changes to the Mass itself, none of which were expressly called for by Vatican II, have contributed to the dearth of faith and practice and actually accomplished what those Protestant reformers wanted. And thus, perhaps just talking isn't enough to bring about a revival. Certainly not talking to the choir. Perhaps Father Stravinskas is onto something about what is really needed for a Eucharistic revival. Well, that's my take. If you have a topic you'd like my take on, comment below or send an email to r4hpodcast@gmail.com. Come back next time when we will tackle a new issue. Until then, run the race, fight the good fight, and keep the faith.